My name is Catherine Mangue Ward. I'm a senior editor at Reason Magazine, and I am joined by...
I'm Tim Fernholz. I'm a staff writer at the American Prospect Magazine, and I'm happy to be here. It should be a fun talk.
I'm looking forward to it. So let's get started with a somewhat timely topic, which is Nobel Prizes. We are awash in them right now. And I know folks here at Reason Magazine have been very excited about the Nobel Prize for Literature, which went to Mario Vargas Llosa, announced earlier this week or the end of last week. And that's partially because he's a Reason contributor, an occasional Reason contributor, but also because many of us are big fans of his novels. What did you think about that one? Just to start off on something a little less political.
Please, yeah. Well, this is embarrassing. I have only ever read Mario Vargas Llosa, I think, in the pages of The New Republic when he goes after the socialists of South America, as he will do from time to time. Mm-hmm. So I'm not, unfortunately, familiar with his literary output, which is embarrassing. So what should I be reading if I want to know the reason he got the Nobel Prize?
My personal favorite is The War of the End of the World, which... is sort of his literary treatment of some of the same themes you might have enjoyed in The New Republic. But I think the real selling point for reading the guy is his pretty outstanding lifelong grudge match with Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I don't know if you know this story, but there's a sort of famous and seems to be actually true tale centers around Mario Vargas Llosa's wife, or ex-wife, but the two of them who, of course, disagree about a lot of political issues, Gabriel Garcia Marquez being a sort of stalwart member of the left and Vargas Llosa being more and more right-oriented, especially the older he got. But it winds up with a punch to the face, Vargas Llosa punching Garcia Marquez to the face, and then a stake being applied to the bruise in full-on Looney Tunes fashion. So I think most of us have read 100 Years of Solitude, and we owe the other side of that fist fight a look.
That's really funny. I think we need literary feuds like that in the United States now.
I know, right?
Do it down there.
Absolutely. So let's talk about... maybe a more political nominee, which is Diamond, and I know you've written some about that. Why don't you talk about his career a little bit?
Sure. Well, Peter Diamond is an economist at MIT, and he is an older fella. I think he's in his 70s now. He was actually Ben Bernanke, the current chairman of the Federal Reserve's professor, back in the day. And Peter Diamond was nominated, last winter, early this spring maybe, several months ago, to be on the Fed board, alongside Bernanke and a couple other folks. And he was rejected by the Senate sort of on procedural grounds, but mainly because the Republicans, and in particular, Richard Shelby, who's the ranking member of the Banking Committee, said that this guy's not qualified to be on the Fed board because he is not a specifically monetary policy economist. Now, that's never been a requirement before. There have been non-economists on the board. There have been economists with different specializations. So it's funny, after all this back and forth over his qualifications, I think it's clear the Nobel Prize Board has it in for American conservatives after nominating Krugman and or awarding it to Krugman in 2008, and now they're giving it to Diamond. Richard Shelby has come back and said, that they don't decide who's qualified, which is true, the Senate does. But I think it does sort of put in sharp respect, what we're talking about here when the president can't put a Nobel Prize-winning economist on the board of the Federal Reserve. So I think it's going to be politicized, but I think it is sort of a statement about how hard it is to put expertise where it belongs and the problems with our nominating process. So I don't know how much you know or care about what the Fed is up to these days, but I'm curious what your take is on, whether the president should be able to nominate someone like this and have a vote on them if, most people think they're qualified.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's this, kind of new thing that's happening more and more, or it's an old thing that's happening more and more of falling back on the notion of qualifications. This is something that we've obviously seen with a lot of judicial nominees, that where rather than argue for various reasons that, you know, a particular batch of Senate Republicans just doesn't like the politics of a particular nominee, people tend to take refuge in this idea of, oh, this person's not qualified. And I think that's harmful because in the end, it does open up critics of a particular nominee to this kind of absurd situation that we have ourselves now in with Diamond. And you know, I think both sides do it pretty equally.
Sure.
And I'd be interested to hear if you think that's not the case. But that...
Well, I think... Oh, go ahead, please.
Well, just that by saying this person isn't qualified instead of by saying... We don't like this guy, and you know, like it or not, it is the prerogative of the Senate to, you know, to veto nominees to these various positions. You know, I think it makes for a dishonest debate when we start talking about qualified or not qualified, especially when we're talking about people like Diamond or about virtually every judicial nominee, possibly with the exception of Harriet Myers, all of whom are incredibly successful, and you know, well-credentialed human beings. It's not about their qualifications. It would be better if the Senate and the president just all said, we're picking this guy because he's our guy and we want him in, or we're rejecting this guy because he's not our guy and we don't want him in.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're actually right. You know, I think, I'm trying to remember, the Democrats in the Bush administration were bad about this stuff on judicial things, but I don't recall them making a big fuss about like economic appointments like that. But I think, you know, you saw, you know, Democrats filibustering, President Bush's judicial nominations. I, with Harriet Myers, they went after the credentials, but I think more, they were a little more upfront about saying, you know, we're going after this person because they have ruled on abortion in ways we don't like, or they have done this, you know, they're an extremist. But
well,
I think your point
is
well taken that.
Let me just interrupt you briefly and say, I think the accusation of extremism is often used in exactly the same way. That you know, people on the left, mainstream Democrats, tend to turn to this sort of talking point that you know, people who I often see as relatively principled, consistent conservative nominees are outside the mainstream or extremists. And I think it sort of falls into the same category of not useful accusation in these debates.
Yeah, no, and I think the idea that people need to come out and say, look, you know, the liberal president is going to nominate some liberal people and the conservative president is going to do the same. And I think the question is, you know, A, you know, how much right does the president have to do that? And I think they should have a lot more latitude. I'm one of those progressives who thinks the filibuster should be severely curtailed or done away with. I was not one of those people championing about filibuster reform in the Bush years, and I look forward to my future consistency on it, even as I perhaps regret that stance. But I think that you know, we need to give the president more deference on who he appoints. Not necessarily on what he does, but who he appoints. And I think especially on positions that are sort of economic policy making positions, but even on judges as well, it's people need to come out and say, look, we have ideological preferences, we're not going to agree, and the president has a right to have an up or down vote on this. And it's not even a question, you know, to take it from nominations to specific, like, filibuster reform issues. It's not even a question of whether, you know, the Senate can veto this nominee, which it certainly has the ability to do under the Constitution. It's whether Richard Shelby or a minority of senators can do it. And I think that's a real problem, with the Senate. I don't know, have you looked too much at the Senate procedural issues? I know folks on the right are sort of skeptical about the convenience of progressives making these arguments, but, you know, again, I think that it's going to be an enduring issue. Whatever happens the next time there's a conservative president, I think, you know, there'll be more agreement than we might anticipate that we still need reform in the Senate.
I have to say, I love the phrase that you just deployed there. What was it? I look forward to my future consistency on this issue.
Yeah. I don't think anyone will believe me when I say, yeah, you know, I'm going to be consistent on this in the future, but I'm certainly going to try.
No, I think that's fair enough. Of course, this is one way that being, you know, I identify as a libertarian, and this is one place where it's always quite convenient because the pox on both your houses stance has a long and proud history amongst libertarians. But, you know, I actually think there's something to be said for a kind of arms race on the Senate procedural shenanigans versus presidential procedural shenanigans. I mean, there's a basic setup, which we have this notion, you know, economic appointments should basically be the business of the president, whereas judicial appointments merit more oversight for whatever reason. But what happens, in fact, is that, you know, the more that the Senate makes these appointments hard, the more the president is going to turn to the tools that he has, which are things like recess appointments. And I have always been something of a skeptic of the call for an up or down vote as opposed to control by the minority. I mean, the Senate is built to be able to be controlled by the minority in certain circumstances. It's not, to use an overused phrase, it's not a bug, it's a feature.
I would quibble with that, I think.
You think so?
Well, go ahead, finish your thought.
No, I mean, I think that, you know, a Senate that smoothly functions on pure up or down votes in all circumstances is not the vision of the founders. And while I'm not an originalist or don't have this particular fetishizing of what the founders wanted, I do think it's not bad that, you know, there are various procedural tricks where occasionally the little guy can run the show.
Just to briefly rehash this debate for a minute, but if you look back at why the filibuster emerged, it was an accident when the Senate realized that they didn't have a way to end debate. You know, it's not something that the crafters of the Constitution envisioned. It was Aaron Burr's lame duck vice presidency when he was sharing the body on his way out of town. And, you know, there's a big difference for a rule that's supposed to make sure that everyone is around for a debate, you know, in an age when Congress met for, you know, limited sessions and everyone came on a horse to see what was going on and making sure nobody sort of got the runaround, to today when, you know, most senators live in Washington and are here five times a day. And, you know, we need to look at, I think, how we actually legislate, you know, the practical realities of making law and say, well, maybe this rule is not the most helpful. I mean, the filibuster was never intended by anyone to say, you know, 40 senators or one senator making a hold can stop procedure for 30 legislative hours. I mean, I don't think that was in anyone's original vision, and I think, you know, saying that's what people intended is a bit disingenuous. And I think regardless of the past, you know, we should be able to say right now we have a lot of things to do in this country and we need to make our institutions work for us and not the other way around.
Certainly you're right that the filibuster is a historical accident. I don't challenge your history of it, but there are other elements built into the legislative structure where you know, one or two or five or ten people can stop legislation. And of course, you know, from my perspective, all of these debates are ultimately about, you know, what do I think is going to be best, you know, best suited for producing the outcome I want. And I think that the existence of the filibuster as a tool, the existence of stuff like holds and you know, in fact, even just you know, killing things in committee means less stuff gets done. And I think this is probably the fundamental divide between you and me. I want less stuff to get done. I don't think that's a bad thing. I do think with appointments, that's a little bit of a different matter. It doesn't really benefit anyone to have no one running various departments or no judges on the bench. But I think that's a separate matter.
Let me step into my Rawlsian liberal original position for a minute and make the libertarian case for
that
procedural
veil
reform.
Of ignorance looks lovely on you.
I wear it almost every day. you know, the thing is, you know, status quo, if you're a conservative or a libertarian, you know, not the government not doing anything may seem appealing, but I think, you know, the problem there is y'all guys have a lot of things you'd like the government to stop doing or change doing or, you know, have your you know, to make the most obvious circumstance, you know, taxes go down, spending go down. And, you know, if Congress, for instance, right now, let's say after the break, after the election, after the break, we come back and the Bush tax cuts are still on the table, you know, let's say the Republicans win a majority in the Senate. Should Democrats be able to filibuster and make sure that nothing happens so that all of the Bush tax cuts, you know, return in full force or are completely ended? I think if I were a conservative or a libertarian, I would not be super happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, you're quite right in that particular instance. You know, that wouldn't be the outcome that I want. But I'm, you know, I'm handicapping over the long term, and it seems like there's a reasonable case to be made that while there are lots of things about the status quo that I would like to see changed, making it easier for the legislature to do stuff of all varieties, including repeal stuff, means the government will get bigger and not smaller. That's, I think, you know, a not a proven principle, but one that, at the very least, as a pessimistic libertarian, I am willing to operate on. But let's actually shift a little bit into sort of a natural segue. In fact, the legislature is currently out of town because they are campaigning. We are in election season. So what so far to you have been the highlights and lowlights of the campaign, and how are you feeling about November?
Well, geez. I think in terms of lowlights, you know, this cycle has just been nuts. I think it's just been so
That's not a highlight?
I was reading, I was doing some research the other day, and I was reading an article about, I think, the 2004 elections, where someone just offhandedly said, or no, it was the 2000 elections, it was a Texas Monthly article, and someone just offhandedly said, you know, this year's gonna go down in history as the kookiest election year we've ever had. I mean, nothing's ever gonna top this. And now looking at 2010, I was like, what was anyone thinking? It just gets crazier.
Look at those amateurs.
You know, we know how to do crazy now. I mean, this is American innovation. You thought we had crazy politicians a decade ago, 20 years ago. Now we have nuts politicians. But more seriously, I mean, look, I mean, from my sort of policy perspective, I mean, I think it's safe to say that, you know, progressives are not going to be doing very well. Liberals are not going to be able to do very well after the election. I mean, I think most people say it's a foregone conclusion the House is gone. Most people say it's a foregone conclusion that, you know, there are going to be losses in the Senate for the Democrats. The Republicans could get it. I think, you know, that's sort of expected. You know, people are saying, you know, Democrats are managing expectations. But I think it is really true. You don't often see the president's party gain in a midterm with a crappy economy like we have right now. So It's going to be well-deserved. And I think the highlight for me has been seeing those sort of progressive politicians who voted for the Obama agenda, like Tom Perriello in Virginia in particular, who are out there having some integrity and standing up for what they voted for and actually campaigning on it. You know, I'm sort of embarrassed to see people who took votes on things and then turn their back on the campaign trail. Maybe that's politics, but shame on them. I think right now the exciting question is sort of what happens when Republicans come into power. You know, I don't know that you'll agree with my analysis that they've been obstructive to the point of being bad faith legislators, but when they have to take responsibility after November, or rather in January, I guess, when the new session starts, I mean, I'm looking forward to what they're going to actually want to do. It's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, while I actually have a bit of a pet peeve against the phrase bad faith, I think that there's one thing that you and I can definitely agree on, which is that Republicans are not principled defenders of small government. And Tea Party people aside, and a few campaigns really focused on cutting debt and deficit aside, Republicans have just over and over shown themselves to reliably come into power and immediately toss aside all of their small government rhetoric. So that's what I sort of expected and pessimistic about for the fall or for the winter is when Republicans do come into power. I don't see any particular reason to think that they are going to deliver on some of the talking points and some of the sound bites that have been the most effective for them on the campaign trail. And I always find that a little baffling, actually, that, you know, they would see, I guess it's not really that baffling, that's naive, but that they would go out on the campaign trail, that they would talk to people in these town hall meetings and on the stump, and that they would hear their constituents, their core voters, saying government is too big and all the other stuff that we hear at T Tea Party protest, but also just in your basic kind of Republican, you know, dining room meeting, and then come back to Washington and do what they've been doing all along, which I think, unfortunately, is the case. Of course, part of the reason for that is the astonishing rates of incumbent return in Washington. And I think when we talk about these very controversial races and these close races, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that even if there is a huge amount of turnover, even if there is an unprecedented amount of turnover, we still will be talking about something like, I think in the last 30 years, the Senate has never fallen below a 75% return rate for incumbents. So it's the same people. And of course, it matters who's in power, but it's worthwhile keeping in mind that the cast of characters is not going to change fundamentally, even if the control of the House and Senate do.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think it's especially interesting in a year when people are going around saying it's an anti-incumbent year. You know, that's sort of been the big narrative. And as you point out, it's not really going to be true. And I guess, you know, I would ask, you know, one thing I did want to mention is I think you mentioned the Republicans coming back, listening to their constituents, and then going and you know, sort of supporting big government anyways. And I think the dirty little secret there is that when Republicans talk to their constituents and say, we are going to cut the deficit at the same time as we keep these tax cuts, and, you know, their constituents look back and say, you know, we want a smaller government, keep your government hands off my Medicare, both parties know they're lying to each other. Opinion polls consistently show that even Republicans love entitlement programs, and votes consistently show that Republican politicians love to support them when they can get away with it. So, I mean, I think it's sort of a funny feedback loop. But I guess my question to you, more to your point, is how do we, you know, freshen up politics a little bit and make it a little easier for people to get in there and oust these incumbents? You know, good liberal that I am, I would love to see some kind of campaign finance reform with public funding so that politicians aren't, you know, judged mainly by how much money they can get from people, but by their ideas and their campaigns and things like that. But I'm curious, that does not strike me as a libertarian proposal, and I'm curious what you think is the best way to get the incumbents out and really throw them out.
I mean, I think the go-to libertarian proposal on this is term limits. I'm actually pretty skeptical of that. While I do think there's a case to be made that deprofessionalizing the political class would have some benefits, I think it mostly would just result in an increase in power for the civil service and the lifetime staffers on Capitol Hill. So I actually don't particularly adhere to what I think is the kind of libertarian equivalent of campaign finance, in that both are, I think, a little overly optimistic and pie in the sky about what those kind of reforms would achieve. Yeah, I think one thing we've seen with campaign finance that we've tried so far, and, you know, we have at the federal level, but also in particular states, tried out some pretty tough campaign finance laws at this point, and money flows around. Money will always flow around. There's a lot at stake, and you know, I think even public financing of elections, which I'm skeptical would ever be actually politically viable, but even that can't keep money out entirely while still being constitutional. So I think, you know, one possibility is just to, you know, to hope to encourage anti-incumbent sentiment in the populace. I mean, there's no ingrained idea, I think, in the general population that experienced legislators are particularly great. People like it when their senior senator brings them home a lot of pork, but for the average Joe voter, I think it would be possible, in theory, that there would be just a general public sentiment that once these guys have been in office for a while, we got to kick them out. But that's a huge cultural sea change, and also, I admit, quite vague and fluffy. But I think, at the very least, that's just an attempt to change people's minds through debate and conversation, rather than trying to legislate various kinds of influence out of politics, which is something I'm pretty skeptical about it working. But I mean, I'm always interested to hear the case, especially from folks that identify as progressives or liberals. You know, how do you respond to the kind of claim against campaign finance or regulations that it's a pretty serious curb on free speech.
Well, I will tell you, before I get to that, I'll just say I think this idea about sort of changing the way we regard politicians, culturally as a society is really important because, you know, people expect, you're going against sort of two ingrained notions. One is that people always love their own senator, congressman, whoever, much more than they like Congress at large. It's almost like they can't connect the fact between the two. But we don't, we don't expect very much of politicians. If you hear about a politician, you know, taking campaign donations from some group and immediately sort of going on their position or flip-flopping or doing whatever, people say, oh, you know, that's what politicians do. You know, that's who politicians are. And I think that's a real shame. And so many people sort of have this view of politics in part because it's almost impossible to succeed in politics without doing that sort of thing, that a lot of people just expect the worst from it. And our best people don't usually go into that. And I don't know, as you sort of point out, how you start that conversation or fix that view, but it's something worth pursuing. As to the free speech thing, I mean, I think, less than limits on campaign finance. I think, Citizens United, I am not an expert on, but I do, feel bad that the Disclose Act didn't pass because I think, if we're going to say that corporations have unlimited speech, they should also have to have their names on it. I mean, I think standing by the things you say in the public square is an important value, especially in politics. And while the law and the Constitution may not be there, I think that's sort of a fair place to aim. But to me, I think what strikes me as valuable is encouraging the impact of small donors, right? Because you saw, at least with the internet, and I think this, people associate this with Obama or Howard Dean, but I think you've certainly seen it on the right as well, that people who feel they a politician is speaking their language can really show their support. And in different polities, I think they do this in New York, they do this other places, there's a federal match, or not a federal match, there's a government match where if you donate $1 to a politician, the government will match you $4 or $5. And amplifying the voice of someone who can just give $5 or $10 or whatever over broader organized interests, I think would be valuable to democratizing the process. And so that's, I think, where I would start.
And yet I wonder about that. I mean, isn't that essentially government picking winners or sort of government offering a microphone selectively? I mean, it certainly is true that the average...
Well, all you would need to do is donate your dollar, and it would match. I mean, the government isn't picking the people who donate are, and they're just amplifying the voice. If there's, 20 libertarians out there who can give $5, that's the same as 20 people who think the liberals are right, right?
But at the same time, I mean, no one is proposing that there be matching for, interest group money or labor money or corporate money.
That's because people sort of think that those groups are problematic, those concentrated interests. I mean, if you want to harken back to the founders as we were sort of doing before, I mean, they said, it's these organized factions that are, problematic. And if we want to sort of highlight this ideal of sort of small d democracy where people hold their politicians accountable regardless of sort of these broader groups, I think that's the way to do it. Does that make sense?
What you're saying makes sense. I think it's a pretty common argument. I think the notion that somehow, a group of teachers who pay union dues and then the union uses that money to influence the outcome of elections, and believe me, I'm no fan of teachers' unions, but I actually just don't think that is a kind of speech that deserves no subsidy in comparison to an individual teacher who gives a dollar to a candidate and that somehow deserves a double or a quadruple or a quintuple subsidy. I think that, while there is this concern about that special interests are influencing our politics, special interests are still groups of people. If for instance, you are a member of a union, you might not always agree with what the kind of speech that the union is pursuing, but it is still kind of an individual who put a dollar into a pot and eventually some speech comes out the other end. So I guess I am perfectly willing to stake out the special interests or legitimate interests too.
Can I put a wrinkle in that?
Sorry?
Go ahead, finish your thought.
No, just that this notion that somehow speech that is accomplished by aggregates of human beings is less true or less part of the legitimate political discourse, I always find kind of surprising and confusing.
That's true, but I think a union is a different case, because a union or like a political action committee is sort of designed to organize people's voices and do that sort of thing. I think with a corporation where you have people, you know, it's getting its money because people buy its goods and or services, but they're not necessarily buying the goods or services of its, you know, they're not necessarily buying its political views. You know, I buy stuff from a lot of corporations whose views I don't agree with, but in effect I'm subsidizing their political voice if they have unlimited, you know, ability to participate in the political sphere.
And well,
I think that's a different story than
it.
When you sort of make a choice to participate in an advocacy group.
Don't you think you could say the same thing about a union, though? I mean, you know, if that's the story you want to tell, you could tell, for instance, the story of my membership in the New York Times Guild when I worked there. You know, I paid my dues because I wanted to have my dental benefits and, you know, whatever else the union was doing, which was a lot, as part of the kind of, you know, employee support structure at the New York Times. I didn't particularly want my money to go to whatever political causes they might have been supporting, but it was a byproduct that I was willing to accept when I handed over my cash to the guild. So I think while it is sometimes true that people do get together explicitly for the purpose of speech, political speech, and that you and I could probably find more common ground on that, I don't really see a difference between someone handing over their dollar to buy a bag of Doritos and then Doritos lobbies for corn subsidies versus handing over my dollar to make sure I get my dental benefits and then the guild lobbies for whatever, newsprint subsidies. It seems like the same to me.
I think you put an interesting wrinkle on it. I still think there may be a distinction where whatever, I mean, I would be curious to hear whether that guild thought, you know, when it lobbies, when it does whatever political stuff it does, is it's thinking presumably of the interests of its members. Now, its members may disagree about what those interests are. I imagine you did when you were a member. But for a corporation, you know, it's not acting in the interests of its customers who give its money. It's acting in the interests of its investors or its management or whatever. I don't know. I think it's clear though that this is a complicated discussion and there's no easy way to get rid of all the incumbents in Washington, which is a
problem. I quite agree. And although I would say my whatever bit of my Dorito dollar that goes to making Doritos cheaper, while I'm not particularly happy at all about corn subsidies, that is could be argued to be in the customer's interest, because who doesn't want delicious, cheap, artificial cheese in their lives? I think we can all agree that that is an absolute good. But let's
three words on that would be food safety regulation.
Well, we will leave the artificial cheese food safety debate for another time. But let's talk a little bit about something that you and I have both covered and I think disagree on, which is regulation of personal finance and consumer finance products. This is you know, something that is obviously a very hot issue right now, partially because it's been swept up in some broader financial reforms of stuff like mortgages and things that affect sort of very, very large scale global finance issues. But I think something that comes home to a lot of individuals is, you know, what does this mean for the fees on my credit card? What does this mean for the fees on my checking account? And the fact is that some of this stuff is getting lumped into the same legislation. So maybe you could just start by kind of saying what you see as the role of the federal government or even state governments, if you like, in influencing the way people interact with their banks or the institutions that exist in the absence of banks.
Sure. So what I think you're referring to is in the financial reform bill, there's this new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and mm-hmm. it's a brand new federal regulator. We've never really had anything like it before that is going to supervise any financial institution that gives consumers credit products. So that's mortgages, car loans, that's checkbooks, that's savings accounts, things of that nature. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said car loans. Most car loans are actually exempt because the auto dealers are a ferociously good lobby. But I think that the federal government has a couple rules, because the thing about, you know, the consumer credit markets is they're really, really crappy markets. And I think going around and pretending that the government does not basically create the markets that we all act in is a sort of a silly idea. And you know, the way you look at this is, you know, when you're talking about an economic transaction, there are a couple things that you need. You need information to make your decisions, and you need an understanding of your risks and costs. And when people go out and they look to buy a mortgage, or they look to buy a credit card, or they're going to pick their bank, or they're going to do a checking account, whatever, you cannot, especially just an individual consumer, compare effectively the price of the product you're getting. And oftentimes, you looking at those documents will not know what's going to happen down the line. And the great example of late are mortgage loans. You know, that's what drove the subprime mortgage bubble. And you saw people getting loans that they shouldn't have gotten. Now there's sort of debate over who's responsible for that. But I think the fact of the matter is if you're a mortgage broker who sells thousands of loans a year, who knows how many loans a year, versus one consumer who's going to buy, you know, maybe one, maybe two mortgage loans in their entire life, there's already an information asymmetry. You know, they already have an advantage. And then when they go and they look and there's this document, it's 50 pages, the disclosures are confusing, you don't understand what you're getting, the teaser rates, the rates change, all of this, you know, people are not making good decisions, and that's a recipe for bad markets. And I think that's what we've seen. So I think the government has a couple roles in setting this up. One is mandating different kinds of disclosure so people know what they're getting into. And there's talk of sort of basically a principles-based regime here where people need to know what it's going to cost up front, what it's going to cost down the line, and how it compares to similar products. And then I think, and this is not in all the law, but I think that the government should be able to prohibit certain business practices. One of them, I think, is usury. I don't think that there's any room for, you know, interest rates of over 100% on loans in a functioning advanced economy. There's no need for that. And I think the government can help encourage fair lending, and it can help encourage, you know, access, most importantly, to banks. So that's sort of where I think the government comes in, and I'm curious to hear what you think, but I also want to get to the specific case of overdraft fees, because I think they're sort of illustrative of the debate here. So take it away if you want to talk about that that item you wrote on that the other day.
Sure. So just to sort of get into the overdraft fees question, I think that it is a great way to highlight the debate, because it gets very quickly to the fact that regulations have costs. And when we're looking at the, you know, the various people who, and in general, we're talking about people who have a small amount of money in the bank, usually have stripped down very minimal accounts. So these are not accounts that have bells and whistles built in, which are obtainable by sort of your usual middle class bank patron. And what happens when you start saying stuff like, okay, overdraft fees are prohibited, or they're only allowed under, you know, sort of unrealistic circumstances, like people sort of signing papers saying that they totally love overdraft fees and want to have them all the time, then what you get, and I think this is really a sort of undeniable fact, is that you get banks saying, well, then we don't want to cater to customers who are likely to overdraft their accounts on a regular basis. That costs us money. There was a study that found recently that about half of all checking accounts are unprofitable. It costs a bank about $250 to keep a checking account up and running. And in the era of free checking, which I think you and I have been lucky enough to live our entire banking lives in, you know, a very, very small account with a consistently low account balance means the bank can't make money. And you're asking the banks to provide products that they don't make money on. And they're not going to do that. So instead, they're going to get out of the business altogether. That pushes people into the ranks of the unbanked, which I think is a sort of fantastic, relatively new term. And these are people who use check cards, prepaid debit cards, check cashing places, payday loans when they need a little credit. And it's quite expensive to do that. It's expensive to be poor. That's a sort of truism. But I think that if you are concerned, you know, to go back to a little Rawls, if we're concerned about the least well off, then you have to face the cost of these kinds of regulations. And while disclosure, I think, is a slightly separate issue, stuff like limiting fees, limiting interest rates means simply that those products aren't available to poor people anymore. And I'm not sure what the response is to that, except
I'm happy to give it to you whenever you're ready.
Except for the usual, credit unions can somehow save us, which I've never heard a super compelling case for that. So if you have that one, fire away.
Sure. So here's my case, and it's, you know, we have a great example in the overdraft rules that the Federal Reserve recently made. And the question isn't just the cost of regulation, but the cost of not regulating. And I think it's funny that if you talk to the advocates for people who want to get people into the banking system, they're also the same people who always advocate for more rules on banks. So it's sort of interesting. But to this specific point, the thing about free checking, and it's always funny when you hear someone on the right argue that we really should be getting free things from banks. I mean, I come from, I don't expect a free lunch. I'm willing to pay the bank for holding onto my money. But when you talk about free checking, the reason that it's free for you is it's being subsidized by those very people on the low end of the spectrum who get stuck with all of these overdraft fees. Because most people, as you pointed out in that piece, who have, you know, a substantial income, a lot of assets, they're doing okay, they're not going to accidentally run their checking account down and overdraft. The people who do are the folks at the low end who, you know, live paycheck to paycheck. They have a debit card or a checking account. They got to pay their rent. They bounce that check. They get stuck with a fee. And they're the ones who pay for your free checking. That's a problem because it strips poor people of assets, makes it harder for them to earn their way up into the middle class. Now, you talk about those fees, and the reason you know overdraft fees are something of a mug's game, in my view, is when you look at this, when you charge an overdraft fee, it's typically a $20 to $35 charge for every time you overdraft. In essence, it's a short-term loan from your bank, and, you know, if you bought a latte, you're suddenly paying, you know, 700% interest on a short-term loan. You know, it's a $5 thing. But what really gives it away is that when you have a stack of overdraft charges that count up, the bank always uses the largest charge first. They say they do that because they assume that's the most important, but they're going to clear all the other ones too. So why would they do that? It's because it gets you down to below the limit faster. So instead of getting one or two fees, you get four or five. That adds up, and then people lose money that way. And that actually is one of the prime reasons that people are actually driven out of the banking system. I wrote an article this past spring about a bank in New York, a bunch of banks that have come together with Michael Bloomberg, the city government, to look at why people are unbanked. And it's not because, as people sometimes assume, that they don't have access to banks in their neighborhoods. You know, you don't have a branch of Bank of America in a low-income neighborhood. In fact, oftentimes people do. The problem was the products. People understand the fringe financial services because even though check cashing places and payday lenders are, you know, exorbitantly overcharging people, the fees are upfront and they're flat. But if a low-income person gets a free checking account and no one tells them that they have opted into overdraft fee, they get their bank statement back a month later and suddenly they're $100, $170 in the hole. They don't understand why. And that's what makes people go unbanked. There's great research of this. I'll put a link to it on the side, but the research goes into these different neighborhoods all over New York and finds it's a question of products, not availability. So then you say, you know, what kind of products do people want, especially people who are unbanked and fringe financial services? They want products that are simple and they're easy to understand. So what the Federal Reserve did, and you have to go back actually to the FDIC in 2008, did a study of bank overdraft fees. And they found that banks make 75% of their fee income from overdraft fees. And that's a huge amount of a business model that's basically based on hoping people do something to incur a penalty, right? And so what the Federal Reserve said, it wasn't a very draconian rule at all. They just said, look, you need to give people an opportunity to opt into this. They have to know what they're getting before they get it. So when that happens, now people know up front what they're getting into. That makes it easier for folks who, you know, are not used, especially, you know, in the immigrant community, low-income community. They don't have a history of family banking. No one gave them financial education as children. When they come into that, now they have up front what they're getting into. But the most amazing part, and the part where, you know, this BS about charging on all checking accounts is foolish, 75% of people have opted into the overdraft. So most people, especially upper-income people, see the overdraft and they say, sure, you know, I could run into that problem, I'll take it. But the people who are on the bottom edge, who are getting driven out of the banking system, can see this coming and say, you know what, I'm going to take no overdraft protection, I'm not going to get hit by these fees. So you see an outcome where the banks are still going to have an opportunity to get overdraft fees from people who are opting into it, but the people who get hurt by this are not going to get hurt as much. And so if that means I'm going to have to pay $25 a year for my checking account fee as someone who makes a decent living, that's fine by me. You know, the problem with consumer credit right now is the whole model is based on penalties, not on sustainable loans. We need to get to the point where banks are making loans because they expect to get them paid back, not because they don't.
So just a couple of things. Obviously, the first and most important is the case that's being made about free checking isn't that there's some inalienable right to free checking. The case is that it's something that customers want that was supported by the existing model, and now interference in that model is taking it away. But in particular, I really want to emphasize that banks are not fees are not the only thing that banks do. The reason that that I don't, you know, that I get free checking and other perks in my checking account, even though I never pay any fees, is because the bank can make money with my money. Because I leave it sitting in there for them to do stuff.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, this notion that you're sort of implying that somehow poor people are paying fees and that my cushy middle-class free checking account is on the backs of the poor people's bounce check fees is.
But doesn't that undermine your argument too? If you're going to make that, then why should the bank take away your free checking if they're making so much money on holding onto your deposits?
They're not going to take away my free checking. They're going to take away the poor guy's free checking. I mean, I think this is exactly the point that I'm trying to make, that while people who are in the, you know, upper rungs of the bank's customers will be able to continue business as usual, you know, by some mechanism that the banks will find, and in fact, there's nothing that says that free checking is illegal now.
No, not at all.
What's going to happen?
There's nothing that even caps the fees. All you have to do is tell people.
Absolutely.
All you have to do is tell them.
But what is undeniably going to happen is that poor people, these same people who can't pay their bounce check fee right now, are just going to be charged for the privilege of keeping an account. And as you say, you know, for better or for worse, financial literacy is, in fact, for worse. Financial literacy is not as good as it could be in this country.
But
so people are going to see this upfront fee and say, it's not worth it. I'm out of here.
That's not what practice or studies suggest. Especially when you think about it, the average fee for a checking account is less than that of one overdraft charge. So if you pay a fee and have your checking for a year, you're going to do better than if you overdraft once or twice in the whole year. And a lot of these folks on the lower end of the spectrum are overdrafting a lot more than that. And in fact, many of them, after an initial experience with overdraft fees, leave the system altogether.
And the point of all this
research is that the upfront understanding of the fee is much more conducive to getting people into the banking system than not disclosing it and then, you know, having people get piled on. And I think it really, the fact that the bank's business model depended, apparently to the point where they have to cancel free checking accounts, depended on not telling customers what they were buying. Think about that for a minute. The bank was not telling customers what they were buying, and now that they have to tell their customers what they're selling, they say they can't sell it anymore. Now, to me, that seems pretty fishy, and that seems like a situation where government intervention is a good idea.
I just think that's a, you know, that's a story that you can tell about the situation, but it's just, it ignores some really crucial elements that while these fees are were absolutely central to making checking accounts for people who keep low balances possible, that at the same time, instituting an annual fee or some kind of regular fee for having a checking account, or to talk about another product that's in this category, capping rates on stuff like payday loans or prepaid debit cards that, you know, for your studies, I'll match them with some of my studies, which are in states where the rates on those kinds of loans are capped, you see a spike in utility shutoffs, you see a spike in bankruptcy filings, you see a spike in the other kinds of terrible stuff that happens when you're living paycheck to paycheck and you can't get credit. And I think the same thing, you know, can be said about these banking fees where the upfront fee will drive a certain percentage of people out of the system. And once you do that, you know, you're of course right that a couple of overdraft fees are more than this one upfront fee, but that's not
one
how people think. And we know that
probably.
Because of the huge
Bank of America
of
charges a $35 fee
outside the system already.
Yeah, so, I mean, I just, you know, I think it's overcomplicating it a little bit here. I mean, on you know, setting aside, you know, on the payday lending stuff, I'd be curious to see the research about the caps, but you know, it sounds more like a correlation. I don't know. I would be curious to see how they track down the causation between those two things. But
they
I think
just
you know,
compare side by side states with differing laws. I mean, it's a pretty typical way of doing that. I'll throw the link in the sidebar.
Yeah, please do. But you know, I mean, the idea basically that I sort of think the idea that this is an unwieldy government intervention, simply asking banks to tell their customers what they're doing. If that means it's going to create a radical shift in that bank's business model, I think that shows that the bank wasn't playing it straight before. And I think on the question of access, you know, again, if you look at an economic analysis of how it helps build assets, or if you look at an analysis of who's in the banking system now and who's not, it's hard for me to see this as an access denier. And it's the sort of thing where banks generally, when you ask them to do things like make disclosures on mortgage forms, or the famous one is the Schumer box on your credit card. When you get a credit card, there's a box and it's going to have your APR in it. It's going to have some other relevant information. And there's still going to be, you know, another 10, 12, 15 pages of legal gobbledygook where at the end they say we can change these fees at any time, you know, regardless of what we do. But in that Schumer box, you know, when that came out, the bank said, oh, you know, we're never going to be able to give people credit after this. No one's going to get credit cards. And it turned out that was wrong. I mean, I think basically banks, you know, like any other profit-seeking enterprise, are going to go up to the limit as far as they can, making money any way they can. And if that involves being dishonest but not breaking the law, then they'll do it. And I think the government has to take a step in and nudge them over towards honesty. And I think that's what's going to make a better market for people to buy these things.
And what I'd say is just that this creates a sort of – it's a game of whack-a-mole, right? You know, one example of this is the existence of the payday loan industry at all. It used to be that when people needed a small dollar loan, they could do it at their – local bank, but as banks became more regulated and as they moved into other kinds of products, it ceased to be profitable for banks to offer these very, very small loans. It costs a bank a couple hundred dollars to originate a small loan, and if you can only make 15 or 20 bucks off of it, it's just not worth it for them. What happened then, of course, is payday lenders pop up. I mean, it's a very new industry, and they offer to fill this gap, and then you know, regulators say, oh, no, we don't like the way the payday lenders behave, and they sort of whack those guys down, and somebody else is going to pop up in their place. But, you know, I think that a lot of people prefer a world where the big banks might have been able to make small loans, and yet they don't see this as a cost of regulation, as a cost of
well, I would question whether it
is.
Expensive. If you're a big bank, I would question the argument that it's regulation that stops them from offering those loans. And in fact, many banks still do. You know, you dinged credit unions earlier, but credit unions and also small banks still do offer short-term loans, that turn people over. But the problem is that they're not charging these huge rates of interest, which is why they're better, have the ability to market or be in the neighborhoods and offer the kind of products that people you know, want to understand. You know, I think the fact that we're omitting here is that payday lenders just drive people into penury and strip away their assets and impoverish them, is worth noting, because payday lending is not a solution to this problem, and I'm not sure that it's a problem that was caused by regulation.
And yet at the same time...
I think if you're going to say, you know, regulation causes payday lending, so we shouldn't do something, I mean, what's your argument? What do you think the solution is to getting people access? Because I don't think it's letting banks sell them things without telling them they're going to charge them fees. And I don't think it's letting people rack up 300% interest on lenders who profit from digging them when they can't pay back.
I mean, my argument is simply that we have lots of mechanisms for dealing with outright fraud already. And that I think a lot of the bad mortgages that that were sold that led, at least in part, to the national financial meltdown, I think could have reasonably been prosecuted on as cases of fraud. But sort of alternate history there aside, I think there is a big distinction between companies that are taught lessons through the courts about what is and isn't misleading. You can't mislead your customers. That's there's lots of ways to deal with that. Whereas if we get some kind of big top-down legislative or regulatory effort, that what very often happens is you wind up making some kind of product or some kind of service that was previously cheap more expensive, because complying with the rules makes things more expensive, and then other models pop up to try and catch those customers. I mean, you said yourself, well, one reason people go to payday lenders is because they're right there and they're convenient and people can understand what's going on. That doesn't, to me, sound on its face like a bad thing, that someone is out there offering people a product that's right there and convenient and simple to understand. Now,
but it also impoverishes them. I mean, it's predatory lending.
You're right that people do get caught in cycles of lending. Of course, people like you and me get caught in mortgages that they can't afford all the time, too. But you might argue that governments get caught in the same cycle. But for lots of people, it's actually a useful financial tool. Unfortunately, I'm going to seize the last word there because we are out of time. But this has been a great and lively conversation, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Me too. It's been a pleasure, Catherine.
Thanks.